From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, one of the first items on the state legislature's agenda is expected to be a vote in January on the Reproductive Health Act. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on Amazon's new headquarters coming to Queens. And we mark Veterans Day by speaking with a New York veteran helping to prevent veteran suicides. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. One of the first items expected to be voted on when the state legislature convenes for the 2019 session in January is the Reproductive Health Act. It would codify abortion rights in the landmark 1973 U.S. Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade into New York state law. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt has more.
Andrea Miller, a longtime advocate for abortion rights and now president for the National Institute for Reproductive Health, says she expects the measure to be acted upon quickly after the new year. The bill was held up in the past by Republicans who controlled the Senate. But with the Democrats now solidly in charge in the chamber after winning several seats on Election Day and the state assembly already under Democratic control, all that will change, she says.
New York State's elected leaders now have a real mandate to make passage of the Reproductive Health Act a first order of business when the legislature returns in January. We have really the moment with a pro-choice majority, an overwhelming pro-choice majority in the state Senate that can now partner with the longstanding champions that we've had in the assembly who have passed the Reproductive Health Act time and again. And of course, the governor, who has made it very clear that this is a top priority for him and his administration.
Cuomo said shortly after being reelected last week that he wants to see the measure passed by the end of January. And the Senate Democratic leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, who's set to become majority leader of the Senate in 2019, says she also wants to act quickly on the measure. She says the U.S. Supreme Court is becoming increasingly conservative with the recent appointment by President Trump of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And she says some fear that Roe could be overturned.
RHA, reproductive rights, has certainly been an issue that I think we want to make sure, especially again in this environment, that women know that they have reproductive rights here in New York.
Miller, with the National Institute for Reproductive Health, says many New Yorkers don't understand why the Reproductive Health Act might be necessary. After all, abortion has been legal in New York since 1970, when New York became one of the first states to decriminalize the procedure. But the state's abortion laws are in New York's criminal code, and they're not part of the state's health laws.
The problem now is that New York's laws treat abortion like a criminal matter with exceptions, as opposed to treating it as a health matter. So the law sits in the criminal code instead of the health code, and it also fails to make an exception if a woman's health is endangered later in pregnancy.
New York's law permits late-term abortions to save the life of the mother. But unlike the protections in Roe v. Wade, New York state law does not allow abortions after 24 weeks to preserve the woman's health, even when doctors determine that the fetus will not be able to live once it's born. Miller says that gap has led some women to go to other states to have the later-term procedure when their health was endangered.
Even now, when we still have some of the core protections of Roe versus Wade, is that we have women in New York State who have to leave the state and travel to states like Maryland and Colorado or California in order to get the medical care that they should be able to get where they live.
Miller says New York has the opportunity to be the first state to act to protect a woman's right to choose abortion since Kavanaugh was appointed to the Supreme Court. She says challenges to Roe are already advancing in the federal courts. The approval of the Reproductive Health Act in New York is no guarantee, however, that the statute would not be challenged in federal court. But Miller says states still do have autonomy under the Constitution to make their own rules for their residents. And she says she's confident the new law would stand. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, our Karen DeWitt in the program today, Alan, talking a bit about some of the items expected to be on the docket for Democrats now that they have control of the legislature. In January, when the session starts, on the top of the list is the so-called Reproductive Health Act. That's to codify the abortion rights landmark 1973 U.S. Supreme Court decision Roe versus Wade into New York State law. But there is some question about the list and how much can get done with a full Democratic legislature.
Look, there are a number of things to be said here. First of all, the Democrats have a terrible record. We're seeing it in the Congress right now as the anti-Pelosi people get started and all the rest of forming circular firing squads and killing each other off. We've seen it before when the Democrats briefly got control. They said, oh, that was different. There were a bunch of crooks around. No, they do that. Secondly, there is, in my mind, a propensity. Nature abhors a vacuum, so that when the Republicans lose, you got two Democratic houses now. You'll have the Senate, you'll have the Assembly, and then they begin to compete with each other, and they begin to fight with each other. Oh, I don't like the comma here in this bill. I don't like this or that. Some things they got to do. They've got to do the Reproductive Rights Act. I mean, that is an absolute certainty. But there will be many other things, David, you point out correctly, that there are going to be a lot of things that they will have differences on. The one I'd certainly like to see is some kind of decent ethics reform, which the Senate has been blocking. Oh, really? Because remember that all the Assembly people got there themselves under the old system. So for them to yell and scream about the bad old Republicans is correct, and they pass bills and they make ethics reform. But let's just see if some of these cats, rather large cats, you're not allowed to say fat anymore, but these large cats in the Assembly who got there under the old system are really going to change the ethics rules so that, for example, you can't make outside income. Now, my very good friend Blair Horner, who is the top commentator on this, says, well, you know, Alan, many of the people who were for outside income limits were in the Assembly. They weren't in the Senate because some of those senators were making a lot of money. So now that the Senate is in Democratic hands, it may well be that the Democratic Senate, which may not be as well heeled, will go along with it. Yeah, now back, as I said before, to the Assembly, and let's see if these guys who have been passing ethics bills, and women who have been passing ethics bills, are going to be willing now to really make a change where they can't make money on the outside, which is, after all, one of the big, not-so-secret ways a lot of these people get by in life.
Let's talk about Amazon. Big announcement that New York and Virginia were going to split their headquarters in New York. Governor Cuomo touting the plan, saying that New York wouldn't have to pay anything for this, even though I see a headline in the Times, Amazon getting at least $1.7 billion to come to Queens. The pushback is pretty hard. Even one Queens Assemblyman, Ron Kim, wants to introduce legislation to stop taxpayer money going to the Long Island City project. And Amazon actually asked the question before committing to Queens, something you asked the governor very recently about his relationship with Bill de Blasio, the mayor, and if they could get along.
That's right, David. Look, this is a huge expenditure for New York. Obviously, Cuomo wanted to land it. There is that $1.7 billion. Let's just round it off to $2 billion in order to get probably the richest company in the world, if not in the United States, on board to come to New York. It's a lot of money. The question is, how does it get paid out? You know, Andrew Cuomo is done a lot of work on infrastructure, LaGuardia, Kennedy, a lot of these places, and it costs money. But will it be on his watch that all of this money is repaid? Obviously, there'll be bonds and other things to do that. So he has made a forceful strike. He'll get a lot of credit for having brought Amazon, but he'll also get some people who are saying, that's our money. Hey, that's our money, Governor. Don't be so generous with it.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Robert Flack, the only person to serve as chairman of the Adirondack Park Agency and as commissioner of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, has died. Pat Bradley has a remembrance.
Former DEC Commissioner Robert Flack was 85 when he died at his home in Lake George. His publicist and family spokesman, Mark Behan, said Flack died Saturday after a period of declining health. Flack was a pillar of the Lake George community long before he was appointed to state positions. He became president of Fort William Henry in 1958 and is credited with restoring it to a popular tourist attraction. Current Mayor Robert Blaze said Flack was supervisor of the town of Lake George when he first became mayor of the village in the 1970s.
We did a lot together prior to myself and Bob Flack taking over. I'm not even certain the town and village spoke to each other, but he was a very special person. He had a lot of connections in Albany with his family and by marriage, and Bob, of course, became the DEC commissioner for a time, and then he was also chairman of the Adirondack Park Agency. He was down-to-earth, friendly, easy to get along with, and of course, he made the Fort William Henry property one of the most successful business ventures in Lake George.
Robert Flack was appointed chairman of the Adirondack Park Agency in 1975 and in 1979 commissioner of the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Adirondack Wild Friends of the Forest Preserve partner David Gibson says Flack had an imposing presence at both agencies.
He influenced many things that improved the park's environment and the state's environment. He respected the local government and believed they had a voice, but he also knew that the state had a very important role to play in the Adirondack Park.
As head of the DEC, Flack oversaw a state management plan for the 1980 Lake Placid Winter Olympics and pressed for a creation of ORDA, the Olympic Regional Development Authority. Adirondack Mountain Club Executive Director Neil Woodworth says Flack is credited with saving the 1980 Winter Olympics.
It could have easily been a disaster. He was proactive. There was, uncharacteristically heavy snows that made Route 73 very difficult to negotiate. And he did a great job ensuring that people could get in and out of the 1980 Olympics. Just because he moved aggressively and came up with a plan quickly and put it into place quickly.
Woodworth says he didn't know Robert Flack until Flack was appointed by then-Governor Mario Cuomo to the Commission on the Adirondacks in the 21st century.
He's best known for his minority report, which he issued before the main report. Many people thought he sandbagged the Commission on the 21st century by issuing that minority report 2 weeks before the main report was to be issued. The final report of the commission wasn't perfect, but it had a lot of good recommendations, and the Flack report, I think, turned a lot of people against the whole report of the full commission, and I think it persuaded Governor Cuomo that the main report of the commission was not something that he was going to use as his platform for the Adirondacks.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government, politics. I'm David Gustina. Well, as the state and the nation pause to mark Veterans Day this week, we bring you a story about a veteran in Woodstock, New York, who has created a documentary with the goal of helping to reduce the number of veteran suicides and raise the standard of living for all people with disabilities. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn spoke with Marty Klein about his film.
Author Marty Klein became blind while serving during Vietnam. The Air Force veteran who retired as a sergeant has produced and directed a documentary called Why Can't We Serve?
I tell people that 22 veterans approximately take their lives every day. It's outrageous, and we need to do something about it. And I think that my movie and my song will bring attention to this subject because it needs attention.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in June released a national suicide data report showing that the average number of veterans who died by suicide each day remained unchanged at 20. Klein's theme song from the documentary is a veteran's anthem.
I have the will to survive. If I get what I need to stay alive.
The Americans with Disabilities Act requires all major businesses and corporations to hire people with disabilities. This applies to most government agencies as well, with one exception, the U.S. military.
It might be the military doesn't want to have that look of anything but invulnerability. If somebody's in a wheelchair, if they're blind, maybe it shows the military is not as strong as we'd like to perceive. But the reality is 56 million people in this country are registered as disabled. All the federal agencies hire 13% of the people serving in the feds are people with disabilities. So the government knows that they're completely capable. They just haven't made it open to the military people who come out with disabilities.
And the military sends these soldiers into battle and then kicks them out when they come back if they're disabled. They should be the ones that take care of them, support them.
Right now there's a law that says if you've been in the military for 15 years and you come down with a disability, then if you're still highly functioning, you will have the option of remaining in the military until 20 years, and then you can retire getting full benefits. If they lowered that from 15 years to 3 years, then it would give a lot of soldiers the option who have been in already 3 years, who come down with a disability, the chance to transition to a non-combat job, have a chance of a career of dignity, a purpose in life, because they all still want to serve. I think it would go a long way to make a difference for those soldiers, and in the process make a difference to upgrade the standard of living for people who are disabled. Because if you saw a lot of soldiers in wheelchairs or with one arm, in uniform at the airports and bus stations, serving our country, I think most people with disabilities would walk a little bit taller and a little bit more proudly about it.
Viewers of Klein's film have shared experiences.
One of the vets in Washington, D.C., when I showed the movie, he said, "It feels like when we come back to civilian life, we're on an island and everybody else is on the mainland, and somehow we have to figure out how to get to the mainland. Well, that's a societal problem, but the veterans take it on because it's their initial problem. We need as a society to embrace veterans in a healthier way so that they don't feel like they're on an island when they get back to civilian world.
And there's been feedback.
I spoke to three veterans who saw the movie who were forced out with their disabilities. All three of them said if they knew that there was an option to remain and transition, they would have done it in a minute. And that's the problem. A lot of these veterans want to stay in. They want to continue to serve because they believe in serving, and it's a purpose in life that they've been focusing on for their lives. All of a sudden, if you take that away, they have no sense of identity, especially on top of it if they have a disability. But even if they don't have a disability, they don't know how to reconnect, and they don't know how to find an identity for themselves. So identity crisis is a key here. But there's also a key about the moral reasons of sending people to war. If they are trained to kill others in protection of our country, and they come back, and the majority of people in this country think that the war was not a good war, they have an emotional, spiritual dilemma that they have to deal with emotionally and, you know, internally. Very difficult.
You understand that people get killed. But what we do can take away all hope. It can take away your identity. It can take away your belief in just about everything.
Klein says he wants to wake up the military to enact logical changes to match the times. Meantime, he offers one way to change perceptions.
Everybody always says, like, you know, thank you for your service. I'd like to encourage people to ask another question, how are you? You know, what are you doing this afternoon? You want to have a cup of coffee and talk about life? I'd like to meet you. And not to see them as a problem, but to see them as a potential friend. That's the big thing. Right now, veterans are seen as, you know, having struggled and they're disabled and they have issues from PTSD and this and that. They're always seen as the one with the problem. The problem is the society doesn't know how to embrace them in a healthy way. But it's not just an issue for veterans and society. It's an issue for, you know, whites and blacks and Latinos and everybody. Just to be friendlier with each other is so important for our society.
I remember one day I was just sitting around feeling frustrated with myself. And I just yelled, "Damn it! So I'm blind. So what? I'm still alive. I have a life to live here. I have to figure out how to do this."
On July 26, 1990, Congress passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. In the years since...
One of the things we say in the movie is that FDR led the country, and he was the president, and he was also the commander-in-chief of the military, and he did all of that in a wheelchair. And we have a clip in the movie of Tammy Duckworth, who's a wonderful model of wanting to serve, being a combat veteran, flying a helicopter, being wounded, and now she's serving as a senator from Illinois, making a big difference in our country. Of course, those who are disabled are capable. She's a wonderful model of that.
And I don't indulge in feeling so deprived. I gotta make a move to get myself.
While Klein has screened his film at various locales, Why Can't We Serve has its public premiere November 13th at the Rosendale Theater in Ulster County.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1846. Or just listen to podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.